You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the 1970s, directors like Roman Polanski, Brian De Palma, and Wes Craven revitalized the horror genre. They replaced B-movie vampires and werewolves and cheesy special effects with the scary serial killers and possessed children that have become a commonplace in contemporary horror films. In his latest book, Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror, New York Times columnist and critic Jason Zinnemann tells the story of the artists who earned some critical respect for American horror films and set the tone for more vivid, disturbing types of scary movies. It's published by Penguin Press. I'm very pleased to welcome Jason Zinnemann to our show.
Wonderful to be here.
Aren't you a theater critic? Are you allowed to see movies?
I moonlight as a regular person who goes to the movies, but it's true that I spend an inordinate amount of time at the theater.
Well, Dracula was a big hit on Broadway.
You know, one of the themes of my book, I'm pretty sure this is the only book about horror which goes into theater as much as I do. And one of the things I uncover is that a lot of the influences of the directors of this period were the theater of the 50s and 60s. I mean, some of the scariest things going on in entertainment in the 50s and 60s were Beckett and Pinter. And what I learned, at first I thought it was me reading into it because I, from my background, but director after director would mention these guys.
So Roman Polanski was talking about Beckett?
Roman Polanski was friends with Beckett, in fact. He wanted to film Waiting for Godot. John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon referred to their first movie as Waiting for Godot in Space. And William Friedkin claims that Harold Pinter, he adapted The Birthday Party, Pinter's Birthday, which is a frightening play, and he claims that was a huge influence on The Exorcist.
Well, and Friedkin also was married to Jean Moreau. There was this big exchange, cultural exchange between Americans and Europeans at this time. Did the 1970s represent a changing of the guard?
No question. I mean, I sort of pinpointed in 1968 as being a real turning point. There's three movies I focus on in 68, which is Night of the Living Dead, Rosemary's Baby, and less well-known Targets.
But there have been some pretty scary movies from directors like Jacques Tourneur in the 30s and 40s. There was Nosferatu, one of the great silent classics, the Frankenstein movies, and there was Don Siegel's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. There was The Thing. Is there something different happening here?
Yes. I mean, no, there have been horror movies since the beginning of film, and there have been a lot of great horror films, no question. Starting in 68 and in the next period, you see several shifts. One, horror movies become much more realistic. They take things that are familiar and ordinary, whether it's going to the beach or the prom or being a babysitter, and it makes it into something that's to be horrified about. Before this period, horror was more about the supernatural and werewolves and vampires, and it was more escapism. So that's just one difference.
On the other hand, the remakes of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Thing were not as effective as the originals, not as scary.
Of The Thing? Well, I would disagree with you there.
I think the original Thing was fabulous.
So do I. In fact, I just saw the original version of The Thing. It's a great movie, but John Carpenter's reimagined Thing is, first of all, more true to the original story, and I think actually much scarier, although it's in the 80s. But I agree with you. I think the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I think you have more of a point there.
So what was happening here? We're talking about directors, I guess, who were more intellectual than the directors who were already in Hollywood. One of the leading directors of horror films at the time was someone like William Castle, wasn't he?
Well, William Castle, I would say, represents more of this old school of horror. The interesting thing he has is he is the one who picked up Rosemary's Baby and said this would make a great movie, and he brought it to Robert Evans, and Robert Evans basically said, it's a great movie, you can't direct it, because William Castle thought this was his opportunity for respectability. Castle's a brilliant promoter, but what Evans had in mind was doing for the horror film what Bonnie and Clyde did for the gangster movie.
So he allowed Castle to become a producer of the film and gave him a producing credit.
Producer in the, I mean, I think it's actually a little bit of a sad story because Castle played a vital role. He's the one who found this material, but he didn't get any of the credit, and he had much obviously didn't have the say that Polanski did.
Now, how did Polanski wind up with this? He had made art films in Poland.
Right. He had made art films in Poland, and he had made Repulsion, Knife of the Water, and he had really refined his his technique, which was a kind of horror. Repulsion is in some ways one of the most influential horror films of all time. And he was starting to develop a reputation. And what Evans realized is that to do a horror film at this point that would get respect, you needed to get, you know, a filmmaker like Polanski. Because at that point, doing a studio picture about the woman who has, of all things, like who's going to have the Antichrist, it could have easily been a ridiculous camp movie.
And how did the critics react?
It's interesting. There was a lot of good reviews. It did well, especially among young people. But there also were some startling reviews. If you read the LA Times review, the chief critic, who's a very smart critic, he essentially says, "This is a really good movie. That's the problem. It's too good." He wants
a horror movie to be a bit sleazy.
I think he actually had a moral. It was dangerous. This movie was dangerous. And I think back then there were a lot of critics. And I actually think it was a good thing because I think horror movies do raise some moral questions. And there were critics willing to make them back then.
Didn't we see similar mixed reactions to some great movies by great directors like Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which some people call the first modern horror film? Then Michael Powell, probably the greatest English director other than Alfred Hitchcock, he did Peeping Tom. It kind of ruined his career.
Right. No, I mean, I think one of the things I try to answer in this book through reporting talking to people who made these movies is how do these people whose instincts these movies, a lot of them began as exploitation movies or as movies that they were a little embarrassed about. How did out of that did they create a work of art? And I think that's a fascinating subject. The other theme, Psycho obviously is an incredibly influential movie. But the reason I start later is one thing I discovered is a lot of these directors who are of a different generation than Hitchcock were as much reacting against Psycho as in being informed by it.
To some degree, isn't Hitchcock's frenzy a reaction against his own film, or Hitchcock saying, "Hey, I can do this kind of movie too"?
Precisely. Frenzy is a fantastic movie.
And the people hated it.
They hated it. Well, I mean, the great thing about Frenzy is you see Hitchcock saying, "Oh, all you young punks think you could do, explicit violence. I'm gonna show you a murder which is more explicit than you do." And then the next murder he does is you see the same killer, or you see a killer go up the stairs. Up and the camera follows him, and then right when he gets to the door, the camera goes down the stairs and just sits out and watches street traffic, and he just pauses. It's an incredibly radical move, and then you hear the scream. And what Hitchcock, I believe, is saying is, all right, this is before I showed you I could do what you did, and now I'm going to one-up you by showing what you can't see is more effective than what you can.
Because the imagination can make something really horrible.
That was his point.
George Romero's Night of the Living Dead was seen by many directors who'd go on to become big names in horror, including Wes Craven and John Carpenter. What was special about it?
It's interesting. The significance of Night of the Living Dead is huge. I would say there's three different things. One, just the way it was made. The fact it was made on a shoestring in Pittsburgh inspired a lot of people to start making movies. Second of all, obviously it kind of invented a certain kind of zombie, a flesh-eating zombie who is basically going to take over the world. And the third, which is I think the most interesting, is the unintentional thing. And I think one of the themes of my book is that a lot of the greatest innovations of this period happened by accident. And he cast a black actor as the hero, and it's a sort of defiant hero who fights off all the zombies and at the end gets gunned down by the law enforcement randomly. And it was viewed as a real political statement. And, Cahiers du Cinéma raved about a zombie movie and talked about it as this commentary on race relations in America. And that's when people started to take horror seriously. John Landis, I interviewed, mentioned seeing this movie and saying, this is a movie about today. This is a movie about politics, about the counterculture. But, what it was that Dwayne Jones, the actor, was just the best actor they had for the part. And they didn't have many options in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, George Romero was not influenced by Hitchcock, obviously.
Well, actually, one interesting story I learned from Romero is when he was about 15, he worked on North by Northwest, if I'm not remembering this wrong. He was just like a gopher, and he was one of these guys who had some criticisms of Hitchcock. He thought he planned his scenes overly mechanically but he respected him too, no question. I would say Romero was more influenced by Orson Welles. If you look at the classic scene in Night of the Living Dead where the girl eats her father, the shadows of it are very much influenced by old Orson Welles movies.
Well, everybody loved Orson Welles. William Castle actually worked on one of the, I think, Lady in Shanghai, didn't he?
Is that right?
Huh. Yeah. Jason Zinnemann is my guest. His latest book, Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It's published by Penguin. A listener, Ken from Soho, asks, why would a sane person want to watch a horror movie? Answer, they wouldn't.
Well,
there are some people who don't like them.
That's
why
for
do you,
sure.
Why do you think some people find them so exciting and other people just think they're either stupid or waste of time?
It's a great paradox. Why would people want to go to the movies to see something revolting and terrifying, right? That's a great question. And I think that...
is this like going on a roller coaster? Some people love it and some people don't?
One theory is it's like a roller coaster in that it's being scared in a safe environment, that the movie's going to end and you're going to be fine. I don't think that fully explains it, though. I actually think that there's something about extreme emotional reaction that, you know, in a time when you're often worried about what's going to happen in the future and, you know, regretful of the past, when I've never been more in the present, more focused than when I'm scared of a horror film. And that's a very addictive feeling.
Now, what you said earlier is that these directors were making them more realistic. Wes Craven, for example, in The Last House on the Left. Why is that good? I mean, wasn't the old idea that Jacques Tourneur made movies or The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where we don't see the actual horror thing happening, that our imagination played so much more an important role?
I think, well, first of all, I don't think it always is good. But I think the argument for it rests on the idea that what these guys were trying to figure out was what was the most scary thing they can come up with. And the strategy for scaring was if you establish a very realistic landscape, the audience suspends its disbelief. And then if you interject horror or a supernatural into that landscape, it has much more impact than if you establish a landscape that right from the bat is escapist and fantasy.
Have critics changed their minds about these movies, some of the movies? Roger Ebert absolutely dismissed Night of the Living Dead. Has he changed his mind?
I think so. I mean, I think Ebert probably regrets that original review, which wasn't really a review, to be fair. He wrote for Reader's Digest, and it was sort of almost a reported piece about how the kids were reacting to that movie. And the most striking thing about that review is I think he says in it that he hadn't seen a horror film in 10 years. You wouldn't find a major critic today who could say such a thing.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is regarded as one of the scariest movies of all time. People wore masks.
Mm-hmm.
And that has become almost like one of the cliches of the genre.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's it wasn't the first killer with a mask, but in American, it was definitely one of the most influential. I mean, Texas Chainsaw on Halloween. See, Italian movies have a tradition of wearing masks, killers wearing masks. But that one was based on a guy named Ed Gein, who is a serial killer, I think in Wisconsin, who would cut off the skins of his victims and wear them. So that's where that came from.
But its director, Toby Hooper, claimed that it was about the Watergate scandal.
Yeah. One of the things that I try to do with this book, because there's been many books written defending horror films or analyzing horror films, and a lot of them look at horror through the prism of politics, which is, I think, a good way to look at it, because a lot of these movies were informed by the times. But through my reporting and through talking to people who made these movies, I think that it's been overemphasized, and often the directors, when they were doing publicity junkets to make their movies seem more respectable, they would claim that it's about political issues, and then people have picked up on that.
Well, they may have also have noticed how much more respect Night of the Living Dead got when people thought it was about current events. Brian De Palma did Carrie.
Right.
He is often seen as the inheritor of Alfred, one of the inheritors of Alfred Hitchcock's mantle, but Carrie is not a Hitchcock movie.
Well, yeah. De Palma's another character who I think imitates Hitchcock a lot, but I think my book gives a completely new interpretation of De Palma. For one thing, he took a lot from Godard, he took a lot from Polanski, but my argument is that De Palma has been analyzed as a great technician who is figuring out ways to riff on Hitchcock in various ways. What I reveal is that his movies are much more personal than you think. And his interest in voyeurism, to take the most prominent example, which people always think comes from Hitchcock, actually comes from an episode with his family where he filmed his father cheating on his mother.
Wow.
His mother asked him to do. The marriage fell apart. And that was referred to by some of his classmates at Columbia when he went there. He called it, I think, his first film. The woman who his dad was with was a nurse. Now, if you look at De Palma's movies, there's a lot of nurses and there's a lot of voyeurism. And if you look at Carrie, the difference between Carrie and Stephen King's Carrie, if you break it down, has to do with how De Palma introduces the theme of voyeurism, which, again, people think is all about Hitchcock, but it is part of it, but that's not all of it.
Now, John Carpenter's latest film has gotten terrible reviews, but he's another one of the key figures here, Halloween especially.
Yeah, he's a major, major figure. Halloween is probably one of the most imitated movies in history.
Why? What did it introduce?
Well, the interesting thing is, it popularized titling your name of the movie with a holiday. It wasn't the first. It popularized the point of view shot from the killer, the shaky cam point of view, which just shows up in many movies, including, I read about it in the book, and Hillary Clinton's 3 a.m. Campaign commercial uses it to great effect. Many directors have taken the convention of, someone has sex, kids have sex, and then they get killed.
As time went on, the kinds of effects we saw in these low-budget films became adapted by, were picked up by people with bigger budgets. And we have movies like Ridley Scott's Alien.
Right, right, right. I mean, Alien, it was remarkable in that it was a $10 million movie, a monster movie, which didn't have a big star. Sigourney Weaver was not a big star at that point. Sort of the unsung hero of my book is, Dan O'Bannon, who really I didn't know much about going into it, and wrote Alien, or co-wrote Alien, and came up with the great idea of, one, of hiring the Swiss artist, Giger, to design this major Hollywood monster, which really was a strange thing to do at the time. And it was that monster looked unlike any monster that had been seen on screen before.
Dan O'Bannon is one of those names most people are unaware of, but he wrote a lot of popular films. Blue Thunder, didn't he?
Blue Thunder, Return of the Living Dead. He wrote the first script for Total Recall. He worked on the special effects for Star Wars. He made a movie Dead and Buried. He was friends with John Carpenter at USC Film School, which I kind of recreate the time at USC. And I think, was a very early adopter of the idea that, H.P. Lovecraft and Philip Dick are key genre authors.
You're doing an event at a BAM series about shock value. Would this kind of series have been imaginable in the 1960s or 70s?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, this is something I'm particularly gratified about, that Dan O'Bannon is having a series at BAM tonight. They're going to show Alien. They're going to show a short he made at USC called Bloodbath, which is the short that John Carpenter saw and introduced himself to. And, you wouldn't have a genre artist like this with a two-week festival in the 60s, not at all.
Well, these films kind of replace the Dracula vampire films of the previous generation. Now we're seeing a lot of vampire films again.
It is interesting. We're coming back to it. One interesting thing is that you often see these stories that talk about how vampires are a new, there were a cycle of vampires. And it's true, we have a lot of vampires. But the vampires really never went away. Even in the period I write about, there weren't that many great vampire movies, but there was a lot of vampire movies. They've been around. They've been popular for a long time.
Do you think that vampire movies have a special appeal because they can mix religion and sex?
Definitely. I think sex and the intersection of sex and violence is the sweet spot for horror, no question.
Jason Zinnemann's latest book is called Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It is published by the Penguin Press. And when is the series at BAM?
Begins tonight, and it's for the next 2 weeks. I think there's about six films, seven films, something like that.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.